right now, it's time for Oh, the Humanities, taking a look at humanities research and scholarship on campus. And as always, we are joined by Max Orr, who heads up Carolina Public Humanities at UNC. Humanities.unc.edu is the website for more information. Max, happy Monday. Good to have you with us.
Happy Monday. There aren't very many left before we go back to school.
Oh, that's right. Well, Durham Tech started today. That's why I'm all gussied up like this. I had to actually be presentable to teach this morning.
That's just not fair. Yeah, no comment on how I'm dressed right now in the studio. Well, Aaron, I always bring you gifts related to today's date, and today is August 13th, and I have to tell you, I'm being very selfish about my first one, because my last name, O-W-R-E, is Norwegian, and you can tell I'm 6'5" and blonde. First. And in 1905, Norway votes independence from Sweden, and it got its first king in
about time
1397, after 500 years of unfair union with other Scandinavian countries. So that particular something that happened on August 13th has nothing to do with our topic today, but very selfishly I wanted to throw that
what
out.
What year
there.
Was that?
That was in 1905.
Okay.
My great grandfather, Peter Jalas, ran away from the Swedish draft in the 1890s to come to the United States. So
back when Sweden had a draft.
If they had voted, you know, a decade or two earlier, I would never have been over here, perhaps.
Man.
Who knows? So.
All right.
We also have a birthday today. It is the birthday of Jimmy McCracklin in 1921 in Arkansas or Missouri, according to our guidebook for this one, Wikipedia. We're not sure which one it is exactly, but he was a rhythm and blues man and admired by Bob Dylan and many others. He's very much associated with West Coast blues, but he is from the American South. And of course is playing the American music of the blues, which is related to our topic today. And
there
so
we go.
I'm very excited to have a dear friend and colleague, Florence Dorr, professor of English, here to talk about her book, Novel Sounds, Southern Fiction in the Age of Rock and Roll, and also an event that's coming up on September 9th at Flyleaf Books, in which there will be a book discussion as well as some fantastic music, because Florence is a polymath. She is a singer, a songwriter, a writer, and runs this wonderful show. So welcome, Florence.
Oh, thank you for having me, Max. It's really good to be here. Thank you, Aaron.
Absolutely. So tell us about the book.
Okay, well, so Novel Sounds, Southern Fiction in the Age of Rock and Roll. I was writing a book about Southern authors and took a break because I noticed that all these contemporary books, novels that I was reading, dealt really explicitly with rock and roll, like Jonathan Lethem's The Fortress of Solitude, Dana Spiota's Eat the Document, which is titled after a Bob Dylan documentary. And I started wondering about that, like, really, how come all these people about my age, about 50, are writing about rock and roll in such explicit terms? These are people who, like me, grew up listening to their parents' Beatles records and Bob Dylan records. And so then I went back and was like, okay, that was a fun article called The Rock Novel. And then I went back to my book on Southern Fiction and noticed that all the people that I was writing about had books that were really explicitly connected to the Southern ballad, a ballad form, just generally. And so then I started to wonder if there was a link between the American novel, the Southern novel in the 1950s, and those contemporary rock novels, and the answer is yes.
Awesome. I just love it when that happens. Like, you make one connection and it just opens up 18 doors all at once.
Another thing happened, another weird, great connection happened. Steve Earle actually recommended this biography of Leadbelly to me, and I read it and discovered around that time that in 1938, John Lomax, just 4 years after he had sprung Leadbelly from Angola Prison in Louisiana, brought him to the Modern Language Association meetings in Philadelphia. So John Lomax brings Leadbelly to the MLA in 1938 in Philadelphia, and he puts him on a panel. This is another UNC connection, actually. Mm-hmm. Puts him on a panel called Popular Music, which is chaired by this guy, Ralph Boggs, who was in Romance Language.
Wow.
And he was a lot of the people who were collecting folklore in the 30s, the 20s and 30s, were humanities scholars. So it turns out Lomax also, going on a little long here,
right,
but it's pretty cool. Lomax, it turns out, also went for a year and as a traveling Sheldon Fellow at Harvard and studied with the preeminent Chaucerian, George Lyman Kitteridge.
What I think is really interesting about that story is that we have this great collection of American folklore going on at the same time, but it's the elevation to the level of literature. It's one thing to sort of go out and collect cultural artifacts and look at Americana and the, how the low people, you know, speak and write or have cultural artifacts, but then to say this is literature right. at the highest level is a really interesting development.
And what's interesting, I'm not really even sure it's a development so much as kind of a, it's one of the arguments of the book that even something like Bob Dylan winning the Nobel Prize in Literature is actually part of an understudied continuity. So, you know, Chaucer's Canterbury Tales comes from ballads, and the fact that it's medievalists, people interested in Shakespeare and Chaucer, is actually kind of key to the argument as well, that they understood completely that the vernacular, what was understood as low in some ways, was always a feature, a crucial feature of the literary, right?
That's fascinating.
Through
yeah.
Shakespeare even, right? Through that
absolutely.
Line.
Absolutely.
Well, Cervantes, right, too.
Yeah.
Like, Don Quixote is, like, the lowest possible comedy, and yet it's the greatest novel of all time.
The first
right?
novel, yeah. some people say. Yeah, exactly. So the novel form seems pretty much bound up with this history of popular music.
So your book focuses on the age of rock and roll, which is, what, the 50s, 60s, kind of that
yeah,
period?
Yeah, I just do the one decade, the 1950s.
Okay.
What I'm arguing, and I do look backwards at that history to give some context to it, but what I'm arguing is that, so Flannery O'Connor names a seminal Southern story, A Good Man Is Hard to Find. She stole the title really consciously from a hit by Bessie Smith in 1927. It's actually written by an African-American bluesman, Eddie Green, in 1919, I want to say. Might have that wrong, but around that time. Anyway, so it's an African-American generated song. The guy actually made money from it, which was not always true because of the racism in the music business. And it was a hit for Bessie Smith. And so this Southern story in the 1950s is based on a black blues song, right? So I became really interested in that. Robert Penn Warren bases his novel The Cave from 1959 on a ballad called The Death of Floyd Collins. That's a hillbilly ballad. So there were these kind of race records and hillbilly ballads in the earlier part of the music industry in the United States. So anyway, I was just really interested in the fact that those authors, and you know, William Styron, Donald Davidson, all these authors, Southern authors and the white authors in the 50s are using white and black ballads to create their fiction. And that's what people were doing in rock and roll as well, right? Because rock and roll is a hybrid mixture of blues, folk, country, doo-wop, right? All these other forms. And so that parallel development really began to interest me. And so I started looking at the kind of causal historical relationships.
Is this something that happened, I don't know, this just completely goes against what you just said about the continuity, but is this something that happened particularly strongly in the South, or is that just what you focused on?
Yeah, it happened particularly strongly in the South. I would say the other great literary explicit use of music would be the African-American tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk a little bit about that in my introduction. It's really for quite different purposes, right? So, Amiri Baraka and James Baldwin and Ralph Ellison all use ballads in their fiction, but to really, really different ends. I mean, one of the things that black authors were doing in the 50s was validating, Amiri Baraka would be a really obvious example of this in his song, novel, or his book, Blues People, is to go back and find, you know, crucial contributions to American culture by African-American artists, and they found in the blues that contribution. And so that's sort of a way to, for African-American writers to connect their aesthetic as literary creators to a black tradition. And so for the authors that I'm looking at, it's a really different thing. They were, and those authors that I'm describing, like Ellison and Baldwin, were barred from the Academy. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I talk a lot about Robert Penn Warren and Cleanth Brooks' influence on literary studies in the 50s and 60s. So they had a book in 1938, Understanding Poetry, and not too much longer, there were like three or four iterations of Understanding Fiction. And there was not a single black author in Understanding Fiction until 1979, which is stunning. Mm-hmm. And it was Baldwin and Ellison, but, you know.
So in terms of this, you know, this sort of similar things happening in rock and roll that are also happening in the Southern novel, of course, one of the accusations in rock and roll is the appropriation of the literary form of the African-American music form, musical form. In a similar way, is the fiction in any way appropriating and recreating and retelling a story, or maybe perhaps whitewashing a Southern history?
Yeah. In a word, yeah. So that would be exactly the difference between the African-American author's use of black ballads and white author's use of black ballads. There's more to it than appropriation, though that is certainly crucial. First of all, there are also white ballads that they're making use of, right? But like in the case of Donald Davidson, he wrote a novel called Big Ballad Jamboree that was only published in the 90s posthumously. Donald Davidson was, as you may know, a poet who remained a segregationist all his life at Vanderbilt. And his novel, Big Ballad Jamboree, is based on The House Carpenter, which is actually originally a ballad from the British Isles called The Demon Lover that Bob Dylan recorded some 5 years later for Columbia Records. But they made really different uses, that is Bob Dylan and Donald Davidson, of this song. For Dylan, he was kind of, you know, mixing black and white forms and black and white ballads, which had in earlier decades kind of been thought to be black or white and to kind of guarantee blackness or whiteness. Mm-hmm. And Dylan kind of made a mess of that by saying, yeah, here's my first record with all these ballads, black and white. So it's kind of his ballad records in the age of rock and roll were interracial. Whereas Donald Davidson went back to that ballad form, as many people did, to kind of link Southern literary traditions to whiteness, right? So for him, the kind of, and for many people writing and collecting ballads, you can see in the introductions this really strong racial component. Like when we go into the mountains in Tennessee and Kentucky and Virginia and hear these ancient ballads from the British Isles, we can link our Southern heritage to whiteness. Right, and this is in the age of Brown versus Board of Education and the Civil Rights Act. So there's a real
through the medium of a black ballad, they can link themselves to the
through a white ballad.
To a white ballad,
so they would find white ballads and do that, that's what House Carpenter was, right?
Okay.
And so so the fact that the white authors are using some white ballads, some black ballads, Donald Davidson is kind of an outlier in my argument. The rest of them kind of. He's an example of what I think Southern fiction was meant to do in the 1950s, right? It wasn't until the 1950s that Southern fiction became central in American literary studies, right? It was previously New England, you know, Melville, Hawthorne, Thoreau. And in the 50s, the South became America's literary center. And so I actually think one of the reasons for that is because there was this kind of, look, we can kind of associate Southern fiction with white ballads. You can see it in the literature, right? And that links us to a white heritage. And this is happening as a reaction against all the kind of changes to race relations in the 50s and 60s.
Speaking with Florence Dorr again, English professor, musician, and the author of Novel Sound, Southern Fiction in the Age of Rock and Roll. She is going to be appearing on Sunday, September 9th at 2 p.m. at Flyleaf Books, along with Will Rigby, who's your husband, right?
You're
going to be performing?
I
still working that out?
We're still working
out
the
dates. It depends on this interview. He's listening right now.
We're still working out the details of the music for that one.
But there will be like music with the reading.
Yeah.
Is that the idea?
Yeah. Some form really cool. or another. Live, perhaps some recordings that it will pepper my talk. But
awesome.
Yes, absolutely.
What does that bring to the audience's appreciation or even your appreciation for engaging with this intellectual project? What does performing the music and singing it bring to you when you do that?
I mean, it's a different thing, right? It's like a different part of one's brain, right, to actually sing a song and enjoy it. But I would say that my interest in writing about it came from that kind of more mindless, you know, a delight in singing the songs and in knowing the songs and listening to them. It's a really fun project, right? Because you go read Peter Guralnick's book, Sweet Soul Music, and then you listen to all. It's the first time I had heard, and of course my husband knew it, Otis and the Pine Toppers, his first recording. It's unbelievable. So it's really exciting to kind of know something about the history, learn something about the history, and then listen to the songs. It makes it much more fun.
And in these events, you get to sort of turn on different switches in your brain, and be like, now I'm in my singing switch.
Now I'm middle age, so it's, I just think it's easy and fun to do. But, you know, it used to be kind of a difficult switch, and now it just feels kind of more natural.
What did you discover in terms of music or in terms of a novel or a work of fiction that you would not have found otherwise without working on this project?
I mean, I guess the biggest discovery is that Lead Belly, you know, Lead Belly was at the MLA, and not only was he at the MLA, but he was on a tour of American colleges. He was at Berkeley in the 1940s. He was at Harvard. He was at Bryn Mawr. And also the fact that he attended Harvard for a year and worked with the Chaucerian, as did Robert Gordon, who established the folk archives at the Smithsonian. He was also a Chaucerian. He quit school and went and started collecting ballads and then started the Smithsonian.
Was Lead Belly like on a panel at like 8 a.m. that three people showed up to
Exhibit
and then everyone?
A.
Yeah. And then I wanted to say at night, was he wearing two hats just like you do?
Yeah, exactly.
Having to flick the switch back and forth.
One of my colleagues in Post 45, I'm part of this really awesome group. It's an international group of scholars working in culture in the post-war moment. It's an African-American scholar himself, and he kind of put it to me like, I can't imagine what that must have been like. If you look at a photograph of conference attendees of the MLA in 1934, they're all white. It's a sea of white faces. So my colleague, Anthony Reed, this African-Americanist who does some work on Lead Belly as well, was like, I feel uncomfortable at the MLA. Can you imagine being Lead Belly? So there are stories that they're told by Lomax, right? And so Lomax has come under some fire for his own racism. He hired Lead Belly as a driver and took him to the MLA and used him as Exhibit A and put himself on as a co-writer of the songs that he published by Lead Belly, right?
Speaking of appropriation.
So exactly, like financial appropriation. So yeah, so there are stories about Lead Belly not being able to be discovered because he got drunk the night before. He's staying in black hotels. Hotels were not integrated at that point in time. So, yeah.
Wow.
Really
crazy
story.
Yeah.
We do have to wrap up in a second, but final thoughts. First of all, Florence, where can people find more information, get a copy of the book?
I would recommend coming to Flyleaf on September 9th. I'll be happy to sign a book. I'd love to talk to you and answer your questions about novel sounds and about rock and roll. I'm going to be on a shout out to Steve Earle on his, Steve Earle, the singer, has a radio show on Sirius XM, the Outlaw Country Channel, called Hardcore Troubadour. I'll be appearing on that show Saturday night. But as to where to buy the book, I recommend local bookstores. Flyleaf is terrific. If you have to, you can go to Amazon, but, you know. Flyleaf
first.
Flyleaf first. They run out, just order it through them.
Have information on our website, humanities.unc.edu, as well, of course.
Terrific. And Facebook. You can follow me on Facebook, Florence Dore. Friend me, and I'll be glad to.
D-O-R-E.
And Twitter, too. Yep. I got Florence_Dore. You'll find me.
You're so 21st century.
Yeah.
Max, final thoughts, upcoming events?
Well, we're excited to kick off our semester, and we'll be bringing more guests as our semester kicks off with all these events and bringing in speakers, and look forward to it, Aaron.
Awesome. Humanities.unc.edu is the website. Get more information. Max, Florence, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Aaron.